Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
Uber has a toxic culture that is plagued by disrespect, exclusionary cliques, lack of diversity, and tolerance for bullying and harassment of every form. These were the words from a very public letter written by two of Uber's earliest investors, the husband and wife team of Mitch and Frida Kapoor. And the letter really put an exclamation point on the series of crises that have rocked what has become the company that everyone loves to hate. And really, Uber should have seen it coming. Frida started the first group on workplace sexual harassment way back in 1976. And Mitch is a legendary investor. He started Lotus, if you remember that. And he's backed loads of other companies that went on to do very big things.
Tech companies have similar problems to what Wall Street had in the 80s and 90s. And so to think that it's special is just delusional.
So that's who I'm talking to today. To get a sense from them of what's wrong with Silicon Valley and what happens when you have a go at the world's largest private technology company. But before we get to that, I just want to get a bit of context for the discussion, because I actually spoke with Mitch and Frida nearly 2 months ago, back when we were just getting this podcast set up and lining up interviews. So what happened this week? A few things. Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, he has taken a leave of absence. That was announced at the same time that the company published the results of an investigation into sexual harassment and culture at the company that was led by Eric Holder, former U.S. Attorney General. The company agreed to adopt all of his recommendations. They're going to hire loads of new people, put in new systems, etc. But Kalanick leaving was the latest in a series of executive departures. Though he's coming back, others are not. So the company is at the moment without a CEO, COO, CMO, CFO, etc., which is kind of ironic for a company obsessed with introducing driverless cars. They have no one at the wheel. Anyhow, that is all to say that when I spoke with Mitch and Frida, obviously none of that had happened. But what we speak about still very much applies. And of course, it's not an Uber podcast solely. We talk about lots of other interesting things, not least of which the importance of establishing a healthy culture right from the beginning, because when companies get big, it's much harder to change, as we're seeing now at Uber. Anyhow, without further ado, Mitch and Frida, hope you enjoy it.
Many people have come to us and said, how does Uber fit into your portfolio? How does this fit with your investment criteria? How is this an impact investment? We would say, look, we're not sure if it does meet our criteria. It predates our criteria. But also, because our own reputation was on the line, we felt like it was important to speak out. And we felt like we wanted to call out other investors who were sitting quietly and not exercising the influence. And they had many, many, many times the influence that we do. So who is sitting on the board? Who is hearing more information than we are? What guidance are they giving? Do you just look the other way when a company keeps having higher and higher and higher valuation? Or do you pay attention to what kind of company it is?
The original investment was made in 2010. I heard about the company in 2009 from Garrett Camp, who was the original founder. I'd invested in one of his other earlier startups who was successful. For years, We were trying to work behind the scenes quietly to advise Uber to help them build a better culture. They would reach out to us sometimes. Frieda had gone over and given a big talk on implicit bias. Then these new allegations started coming out, and senior people at Uber reached out to us, and we were on the phone for hours counseling them. They were not really responsive, and we got to a point of frustration that we had pursued the quiet inside route as far as we could, and as a matter of conscience and reputation, there was no other choice but to say something publicly.
And do you think the message has got through internally? Do you see improvement?
The message has certainly gotten through. After some challenging exchanges, the door is now open wider than it ever has been. Our bandwidth of communication to senior people at Uber is the best that it's ever been. And I can say that they are listening. And it is still a little too soon to know what the impact is going to be.
I do think it is better. I do think they are listening. They have a relatively new chief human resources officer.
Is that Leanne Hornsey? Is that she's British, actually.
Yes. Leanne and Bernard Coleman is the new head of diversity and inclusion. Came from the Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign. We have met with them at their initiation. I was over at Uber a few days ago, addressing all of their heads of employee resource groups. Again, all along, we have known many, many incredibly smart, incredibly committed, principled people that are still at Uber and that really want Uber to do the right thing. So one of the things that we know, and sometimes those people pop up and they say, thank you for writing the letter. We got emails and comments and private communications from lots of Uber employees thanking us for writing that letter. But there are many people who were there who love the company and really appreciate outside pressure.
I imagine that especially the allegations of sexual harassment must have struck a chord with you, because you quite literally wrote the book on workplace sexual harassment. Is that right?
So I started the first group on sexual harassment in the United States in 1976 and have been working with lots of organizations, many tech companies for many decades, but also have done things like I was the on-air commentator with NBC and Tom Brokaw throughout the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings. I've testified in Congress about what legislation should look like. So I have grown up with the issue.
So that's 41 years ago. Here we are, we have these tech companies, which by many measures are the most powerful companies the world has ever seen. Facebook has almost 2 billion users. How far have we come? And it seems that now more than ever, the questions of culture are really important when you have that far reach.
Absolutely. They've always been that important. I think they're getting new prominence and new attention. Progress has been a few steps forward, almost as many steps backwards, and the rest of the steps sideways over all of these years. I think it's important to point out it's also a moving target. In 1976, what we were concerned about is when somebody said, sleep with me or you lose your job. I think that actually happens a lot less now than it did in 1976. So you got to count progress where you see it, right? But what most people define as sexual harassment includes a much more subtle end of the continuum. And I think when I say it's a moving target, I think that definition shifts generation by generation. And a wider range of behaviors is encompassed in there. Tech culture and the law have lagged way behind what people's own definitions are of what's okay and what's not okay. And we don't have a mechanism for people to negotiate their own boundaries at work between what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. If tech culture took these issues more seriously, there are easy, lightweight, practical solutions. But look, tech looks like a fraternity house.
Frieda's perspective is, in a way, that tech companies have similar problems to what Wall Street had in the 80s and 90s. And so to think that it's special is just delusional.
Well, it's clothed in this mission of making the world a better place, et cetera, et cetera.
So this idea that it's a meritocracy is, the most you can say is aspirationally it's a meritocracy, but in practice, anything but. But there's a piece of hidden good news in that, or at least a possibility, and this is people ask us about Uber and can it change? Because nobody has really done it right. A disruptive company like Uber that has already done all sorts of things that people said were impossible, they've demonstrated the capability to be very, very surprising. And so there are ways in which they could step up, and it's not impossible to believe that they could really turn it around.
Is that why it was, I think it was 2 years ago, you guys decided to, you made this pledge to invest solely in tech companies that are addressing these issues?
For us to invest, we want to see founders make a commitment to building a diverse and inclusive culture. They set the goals. They do it in a way that fits with their market and what they're trying to do. We will help them with that. And it was very intentional to focus on startups because they're more malleable. If you can bake in key values and practices at the outset, there's a much greater chance that they're just going to become part of the way things are done. Whereas if you try to change a Google or a Facebook or an Apple,
or an Uber with 12,000 employees, right, it's more
although
difficult.
Uber is still young enough, even though it's large, it's like a 7-foot-tall 12-year-old, which do exist. It is not as fixed in its ways, not yet. The bigger you are, the longer you've gone, and also, frankly, the more successful you are, the harder it is to change, because there will always be people inside saying, why mess with success? This is working for us. We're putting too much at risk. So it's just hard for the more established companies, and we decided to focus on startups for that reason.
When I went about 2 years ago to talk to Uber employees about hidden bias, I think they were 2,500 employees growing to 5,000 that year. So if you think about the average tenure, half the company's been there less than a year, which means it's not a firmly set culture. You don't have just a few people being added to a base of 20,000 or 50,000 or whatever it is every year. You've got the company doubling in size, which means it is completely malleable, that you can reinvent the culture when you're bringing in more people this year than have ever worked there before.
I think the perspective you guys bring is interesting, because when you started Lotus, I think one of your goals was to make it the most progressive company in existence. How did you, Frieda, help make that happen?
That was my job description at Lotus.
Right.
I have never seen it before or since, and that's something that tech companies could do. They could put in a job description for somebody whose job it is to make them a progressive employer. So one of the things at Lotus, it was a rapidly growing company. It was highly profitable. Those are conditions under which you could do lots more risk-taking and lots more experimentation. So we did all kinds of things that were firsts in the industry and sometimes firsts in corporate America. We were the first corporate sponsor of any AIDS walk anywhere. And that was 1984. This is pre-internet, so I didn't email anybody. I called all over the place. On the telephone. And asked people what they were doing about AIDS. And everyone said, we're not touching it. We're not talking about it. There was enough indicators of it. It's going to be a crisis that's going to touch every workplace. And when I said we're going to sponsor the AIDS Walk in Boston, go out there with a banner with our employees, people said, you're nuts and you're going to have shareholder suits. And what was interesting is that when I got there in 1984, I started a diversity council, and it was a diagonal slice across the organization. It had all different kinds of demographic representation. It had every department and it had every level in the company. Most places, their diversity councils are senior managers from each department or something. We had out gay representation on our diversity council in 1984. We all knew gay people in the company whose lives were being touched by this, and so we were all there with the banner. We were the first tech company to sign on to the Sullivan Principles, saying we wouldn't do business with South Africa under apartheid. So we innovated in the mechanisms we put in place to handle employee complaints and questions, so that giving employees a way to do things truly confidentially and even anonymously. Companies still don't touch that. What I say to CEOs now is, if you don't create a safe and effective complaint channel, wait for your Medium post.
Well, because that's a lot of companies have that, but it doesn't. There seems to be a lack of trust in those that they will work.
If there's a lack of trust, they're not safe and effective. It doesn't mean go to HR. HR is largely seen as an extension of management whose job is to protect the company. And U.S. law, and I would say it's one of the United States' worst exports, is our employment law. It puts companies between a rock and a hard place on how to handle these complaints. And given that tech prides itself on breaking things, I don't know why it's been so afraid to break complaint channels or things that are good for people.
If you go to HR, you set a process in motion that you no longer control if you have a complaint. And so that's why people wind up writing these posts in Medium.
So one of the things that especially our British audience, perhaps not everybody understands, is that you come to the Silicon Valley, you have an idea.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
And then you go straight to Sand Hill Road, where all the venture capitalists are, and then you just do laps up and down there looking for money. That is perhaps not the best way to approach it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. So there's a lot of knowledge that has been developed over the past decades about how to successfully create new startup companies, particularly tech companies. And there's a culture here in Silicon Valley that lots of people who all participate in that. It's not just in Silicon Valley. I mean, it's in New York, it's in LA, it's in London, it's in Berlin, but this is the sort of center of it. People who know how that works and who have access to it have an advantage. If you had manufacturing machinery at a time when everybody else was building things by hand, you had a huge advantage. And one of the reasons new tech companies keep happening here is because people know how to apply this knowledge of how to build a startup. So, for instance, when you're just starting out, you don't know if your idea is going to be viable or not. So the chief thing to do is, as quickly as possible, find out, as an empirical matter, if your idea is any good or not. Part of the democratization of entrepreneurship, you know, resides in taking the knowledge of how these things work and spreading them to people and to places where they're not naturally going. And that way you get a more diverse set of entrepreneurs and a more diverse set of opportunities. Because if you had a different life experience, you're going to have had different problems. A problem is just an opportunity. waiting to be solved. And part of our advantage as investors is we are attuned to entrepreneurs who come from different backgrounds. We're actually not trying to cherry pick, but we work with incubator and accelerator programs that are attracting entrepreneurs who are people of color or who go out of their way to recruit an equal proportion of women and men. Part of the game is about leveling the playing field for all entrepreneurs.
What was Uber when you found it?
Well, Uber was an idea, and just an idea. Garrett Camp had started a company called StumbleUpon. It would just show you random interesting websites. Now, you would think, what's the point? But believe me, it was so well done. And I was an investor in that, and he sold it to eBay, and we all made money. And eBay didn't know what to do with it. So he bought it back from eBay. They gave it back to him, basically, for
nothing. Like a dollar or something?
Yeah, I mean, it was like pennies on the dollar. So, and he was raising more money to relaunch it. I wanted to get in. One of his other investors had an objection, thought I was doing something else that was competitive. But I was very determined because I had had the opportunity to invest in Twitter at the very beginning, and I didn't get it. And that's because I was an investor in Ev Williams' previous company called Odeo. It did podcasting. But then Apple gave all the podcasting tools of that era away for free. Odeo's business prospects collapsed. Some other investors said, so Ev, tell me what you're working on. Let's just roll it over into the next thing because you already have the money. That was Twitter. I was so mad at myself for that.
Well, what did you do?
I just got the money back. So here I am. I'm talking to Garrett. I'm really mad at myself, and they won't let me into the new StumbleUpon. So I say to him, well, what else are you working on? And he says, well, I have this idea. Not going to work on it for a year. I'm busy. But we're going to use the smartphone, and we're going to put a map up on it and show where there are car service cars that are available, and you can punch in your location, and one will come and pick you up. Isn't that cool? And I thought to myself, well, actually, I don't think this is a big idea, but it's pretty cool. And you got to remember that the speed of the iPhone connection was still low. It was 2G. It wasn't even 3G yet. Maps barely worked. GPS really didn't work. But this idea of being able to summon a car was cool. So I just said, I'm in. Let me know when you're starting it. And 9 months later, he said, send me a check. I'm starting it.
How much did you invest?
$75,000 in the original and then some more subsequently.
I imagine that's worth a lot more than $75,000.
It is worth a lot more than $75,000. Well, it is, and it's illiquid. And if you believe the FT, your competition.
I don't read that newspaper.
Okay. They say that Uber is going out of business.
It's supposed to be $70 billion, but that's kind of...
But the only valuation that matters is the one at the exit. I've seen things go up, go down. But, you know, Travis, who has control along with with Ryan Graves and Garrett, he is famously on record as saying he wants to have an IPO as late as possible and put it off. He knows that he can't. People who are sort of counting on making a killing or getting their money out, I mean, anytime soon, they could be disappointed.
There's got to be a big secondary market in those shares, though, no?
In general, and the case with Uber, is you get locked up. Part of the deal of the privilege of being able to invest in these companies is an agreement not to go onto the secondary market. The venture capitalists who come in and put the big money in want to control the process up through an IPO or acquisition. And if there's a secondary market, it disturbs that, and it also impacts the ability of the company to offer stock or stock options to employees at the price they would like to convey it at.
And can we talk about the law for a second and where we are today? Technology is changing incredibly rapidly. You founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is about protecting rights online. There does seem to be a growing concern around the government's just lack of understanding of what is happening and the laws that are required to make sure bad things don't happen or that rights aren't trampled, etc. Is this something that you guys are trying to address or thinking about?
We've certainly been thinking about it. One of the things that's very interesting and one of the things that's really appealing about tech is that you can invent something new. And so one of the things that I am quite fascinated by, and we've done some investing in, a new sector that I call People Ops Tech. We've had two People Ops Tech pitch competitions, and it's one of the reasons I'm quite hopeful, is it's leveraging technology to mitigate bias at scale. So we can have these tech geniuses invent technology that can give them real-time feedback about their own behavior. So, for instance, we have companies that we've invested in. One is called interviewing.io. It's an anonymous platform for doing technical or coding interviews online, and it does voice masking.
Is it an electronic,
yes,
like kind of Stephen Hawking type voice?
Yeah, but better.
Right.
Well, and what you do is typically what happens when you apply for any kind of engineering job, you go in and you do this whiteboard exercise, right? So what this does is it replaces that. So you don't have to travel, and you have this interactive coding exercise online. And it tests coding ability, and it tests problem solving. Many, many companies have been using it in a pilot phase and have said people we rejected based on their resume turned out to be the one who aced the coding exam. And aren't you supposed to be hiring just for coding skills? And so they end up hiring much more diversity of all kinds. We have many, many companies like this. Another one that's called Junco that is using AI. It's deep tech, and it goes and uses your Salesforce and your email and your everything else, and it pops up and it says, well, Blake, seems like the last 10 assignments have all been given to men on your team, and none of the women are getting good assignments. So you might want to think about giving the long-term career-building assignments to women. What the CEO, and both examples I gave you were women CEOs, and what the CEO said is fascinating, is that this is, of course, a bot that's doing this, going through all your Salesforce and everything else. People write the bot back. And they say, thank you so much for pointing that out. I didn't notice. I'm going to do better. You're right. Susie on my team could really handle this. So it's just completely fascinating.
I wanted to give you a slant on the law. I mean, one dimension of it is sometimes, not all the time, you can use technology to solve a social problem better than you can by trying to pass a law or regulating it. I think that's really true in the areas that Frieda was talking about. We think it's true in things like payday lending, where we have a LendUp, which has originated over $1 billion in loans and is an alternative to payday lending with decreasing interest rates and rebuilding credit scores. So the idea is to graduate people back to the mainstream credit system, which is a different motivation than everybody in the payday lending, but they're building this huge business doing it. Ben Jealous, our partner at Capital Capital, used to be the head of the NAACP. That was one of the instances when he was leaving the NAACP and contemplating what to do next that was persuasive to him about the power of technology, because he'd been dealing with these payday lending issues and regulators and states for a very long time.
You might want to say that the NAACP is the United States' oldest civil rights organization.
I might, but you just said it. So good point. Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I co-founded 27 years ago, was specifically concerned with rights like freedom of speech. It was in the early days of the internet. It was really 5 years before web browsers, before even the beginning of a mass market, but it was the stirrings.
Why founded then?
Because people were just starting to go online. The U.S. Defense Department gave the internet to the National Science Foundation, and the National Science Foundation was bringing in private industry into it. And so for the first time, ordinary citizens could get an internet connection. So the first settlers of cyberspace were showing up. And so the phenomena of hacking also started showing up in a new kind of way. I looked at the kids who were doing this and got to know them, and most of them, it was like vandalism. It was stuff teenagers do, not great stuff to do, but not highly damaging. There was no organized crime. There was no commercial motivation of identity for identity theft. It was no government spying. All that was to come later. What we wanted to do was to ensure a proportional response, that the law enforcement efforts respected basic rights. And I think EFF was very successful in being in the middle of a group of organizations and a movement in the early 90s to do that. We did not anticipate, nor did the architects of the internet, was that every bad thing that a person can think of doing or doing, they can do in an amplified way using technology. But the basic architecture of the internet, its decentralization and its openness, took no account of that. It fundamentally lacks just even basic abilities to do the equivalent of locking your front door.
So if you look at Facebook, Twitter, which has become just a den of abuse and terrible things being said, how do you address that issue? Because there does seem to be, in the internet's life cycle, we're still in this early days where there is no sheriff in town or sheriffs.
I would say, while we're addressing that, let's also address government surveillance, licit and illicit, and what people can and should expect and do to protect themselves, because they're different sides of the same coin. It's a mess. In the more bad news department, there are fundamental tensions between protecting people's individual rights of expression and free speech and our collective interest in having a safe society and a civil society. What we're doing is a terrible job of having real conversations about it among practical people who may disagree in their values of where they want to see the emphasis, but agree that we need to do something. In fact, the dysfunction around the internet mirrors the political dysfunction in the U.S. and elsewhere, where there used to be working arrangements so that people of different political parties found some things to do together. And that has really broken down and will be replaced by we don't know what. So until we can get the equivalent of real peace talks, of people sitting down, it's really not going to get that much better, because we're patching over. I mean, I think that Facebook and Twitter could be and should be and are belatedly beginning to do far more than, you know, they've done before. But it's a problem that's bigger than any one company. Look at Reddit, which is the sixth most popular site on the internet. It's a tough situation.
One final question. Do you think Uber regrets taking your money?
No, not at all. Enough people there know, including very senior people, that the success of the company depends on surmounting these cultural challenges. They understand that we're an ally and that our kind of public statement, while painful, perhaps, for a period of time, was actually healthy. In fact, I would say I think they actually respect us more for speaking up about this, and they know where we're coming from. And also, we've been really clear, our motives, we're shareholders. We want to see the company succeed. We're not out there trying to score points. We are by our lights, trying to help them become what they can and should be. And we've heard nothing to the contrary. What we have heard is the thunderous silence from the investing community, who behind our backs have started going to other of our companies, hot companies, saying things like, oh, you don't want to do business with KPOR. They're going to turn on you the way they turned on Uber. And so you want to do business with us. Nice, huh?
Really?
So what's the biggest surprise has really been, it's a combination of cowardice and craven behavior. Look, I mean, venture capital is not a particularly nice place. I mean, no one's been under that illusion, but that's been surprising and a little disappointing.
Wow. Great. Thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And that's it. Another episode is in the can. Thank you to Mitch and Frida for sitting down. Lots of great stories, and of course, very clear that there's still a lot of work to do to fix what's wrong with tech. If you do like what you hear, please stop into iTunes, to the iTunes store, and give a rating and review to the podcast. It always helps. And of course, you can check me out every Sunday in the newspaper. All for now. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.